get this. I'm willing to wait till 2010. You know, I'm willing to wait for Voinovich's seat to open up, in Spector's seat, if that gets us to 60. The question is, you know, whether they're gonna be, you know, good faith negotiators now. And I think it's important, to look at all these issues. But, and I do think binding arbitration is the central piece of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. The important thing is getting a contract. It's one thing to have the election. It's one thing to win an election. It's another thing for that election to bear fruit.
Right. So I'm curious to see how this goes. And we're going to be, you heard our ad. We got Martin Sheen to cut this ad for us. Like, we're going to be going full bore on Spector. And I hope he realizes that unless he comes through for working families, he's not guaranteed his primary victory.
Yeah.
And I just want to say something about the messaging on this. I think, for some of the union movement that I've seen so far, as a religious organization, I just want to offer the need to lift up the values-based arguments on behalf of this legislation. You know, we are very intentional in how we framed our ads as working families. Like, this isn't about necessarily a democratic election or a process. Like, this is about basic decency, basic fairness, basic, you know, human values,
right,
family values. And also in our ad, like, we're very, very careful to mention the most vulnerable workers. Like, you know, I work at a desk. You know, I work in an air-conditioned environment. This bill isn't for me. This bill is for those, you know, those folks who work with their hands, you know, who work in the sun, you know, who really struggle, you know, more than I do. In saying this is about helping those who are the most vulnerable in our society. You know, those in the shadows, those in the work that actually brings our food to the table.
I would agree with you, but I would say that unions are for people like you as well, because wages have been so badly held down over the last 30 years that most of my friends who work in offices and work in very pleasurable conditions are still having a very difficult time making ends meet at home. And this is about, really honestly and truthfully, this is about fairness. This is about equality. This is about equity. This is about workers sharing in the profits of what they produce.
That's right.
For more information, CatholicsForWorkingFamilies.org is the website. James Salt, I appreciate you taking time for us. I'm up against another break. I'd love to have you back on and talk about this again in the near future, if you would.
Yeah, can I just give a quick shout-out? We're having a lobby day with SCIU and AFL-CIO May 18th and 19th. We're bringing Catholic priests, women religious, clergy from all faiths to Washington, D.C. on May 18th and 19th to do the rounds in Capitol Hill. And we need good folks from Pennsylvania. So if anyone on the radio is hearing this, come out and join us May 18th and 19th for a lobby day on the Employee Free Choice Act.
All righty. Thank you so much, James. You have a great day. I appreciate you taking time for me.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
We're right back after this. 1-877-960-0960.
The economic environment of the U.S. in 1894 was one of sheer misery. Years of massive railroad overdevelopment and its accompanying shaky financing had left over 500 banks on the verge of collapse, as well as bankrupting nearly 15,000 related companies. As a result, the unemployment rate had reached a crippling 11.7%. Although they had been relatively unfazed by the slowing economy so far, a brave group of 3,000 rail workers in Pullman, Illinois, were about to make some news of their own. The Pullman Palace Car Company, in reaction to the contracting economy and the reduction in available credit, summarily reduced every worker's pay by 25%. The workers were rightly outraged as the Pullman Company, who physically owned the town in which most of the workers resided, had not decreased rents proportionally. A delegation of workers asked to speak with George Pullman, but he loftily declined to talk to them. As many of the Pullman workers were members of the American Railway Union, its leader, Eugene V. Debs, declared a boycott of Pullman Company cars by refusing to run or switch any train that contained Pullman cars. This boycott effectively shut down the production factories at Pullman as well as many railroads across Illinois. As news of the boycott spread nationwide, railroad workers everywhere refused to run or switch Pullman Company cars, and companies were warned that a wider boycott would occur if any worker were disciplined for refusing to work with Pullman Company cars. Receiving no relief from management on the discipline issue, the boycott began on June 26, 1894, and counted over 125,000 workers across 29 railroads among its participants. Not surprisingly, the Pullman Company began hiring replacement workers in an attempt to restart production at its factories. The strike was now getting some attention from the federal government as President Grover Cleveland cited a danger to the U.S. mail system, appointed special federal attorney Edwin Walker to end the strike and restore the railroads to full capacity. After repeated injunctions from Mr. Walker were ignored by the striking workers, President Cleveland decided to literally bring in the big guns. The U.S. Marshals and the 12,000 U.S. Army troops sent by the president to quell the strike were successful, but not without collateral damage. 13 of the striking workers were killed, 57 others were badly wounded. George Pullman may have been on the winning end of this strike, but distaste for his actions lived on within the labor movement. So much so that upon his death in 1897, his funeral took place at night, and his burial plot consisted of a lead-lined coffin placed in a steel vault and covered with tons of cement to prevent desecration by the very people that he exploited just 3 years ago. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. This week, Mr. Rush Limbaugh went to Washington to address the press club, the President's Club dinner, a meeting of extremely wealthy donors and supporters of the Heritage Foundation. Those in the audience were Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, Senator Jim DeMint, Republican of South Carolina, a whole bunch of other millionaires and billionaire trustees of the Heritage Foundation, like Thomas Saunders. And Limbaugh bragged about his $400 million contract with Clear Channel, you know, the defender of corporate America. He gloated about the success of his radio program, mocking the idea that Americans are suffering, noting, quote, I have never had a financial down year despite the supposed recession. He said, but during all this growth, I haven't lost any audience. I have never had a financial down year. There's supposedly a recession, but we've got, what, this May, back in February, we already had 102% of 2008. So I believe that if there were going to have a recession, just don't participate. Yeah, that's easy for someone making $400 million from a company who's fired over 3,000 employees. So while he's out there shooting off his mouth, flying around in his $54 million Gulfstream, 12% of Clear Channel's workforce is out on unemployment. And what's interesting is if you had read Rush's first book, where he talked about the time where he was on unemployment, and he was sitting around on the couch eating potato chips and being just a dreg of society. He's never had a down year, he claims. What a hypocrite. What an absolute hypocrite. I'll tell you. It just drives you nuts, Jake. I'll tell you.
Oh, and the particulars, Rick? Listen to this. He has a car worth $450,000.
Good for him. I mean, good for him. But to come out and say something like that.
My point is, I wonder if he really could care less about the huge cuts.
He could care less. Hooray for me, to heck with everybody else. That's his motto, right?
$54 million jet must be nice.
And you know, hey, that's the American dream. And good for him. But to come out and say, well, there's no recession, or just don't participate. You know, those that unemployment, that meager unemployment check that you get every week to help you survive. Don't bother with that. Just don't participate. What a scumbag. Go ahead.
Well, they've also, by the way, Rick, the company has told their employees that they're going to reduce their contributions to their 401k.
Nice.
And the stock's plummeting like a box of rocks. 2000, it was $90. It last year, when it went public, it was down to 30.
Yeah, but Mr. $400 million.
Correct.
He's going to get his paycheck.
And there are some rumblings that perhaps, just maybe, they overpaid him. Sorry about that.
Well, good. Maybe it'll bring them down. You know, maybe, but here's the thing. Here's what bothers me. Is will we start talking about bailing them out, too? I'm tired of bailout mania. These corporations, you know, there's part of me that says, you know what? Clear Channel, they should go out of business if they overpaid that bloated idiot. I just cannot stand that guy. I just can't stand him on any level.
But it just goes to show you, if you spout the message of corporate America in the right wing, they will take care of you. They always have. They have always had the power and the money. Probably always will, Rick, to some degree.
Well, they always will. I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, if you just think about just those few years after the Great Depression, just a handful of years, the moneyed interests have controlled this country. Just those very few years right after the Great Depression, where we started seeing more progressive legislation, that's when there was something to we the people. Before, it was always, you know, hey, it's just we the people who control all the money.
But it's easy to understand when you look at Russia's lifestyle, how you can live. You can live in an ivory tower and forget about the little people. I mean, is it really surprising?
It's not surprising. We got a call. Let's talk to Anthony on line one. How you doing today, Anthony?
Hello, sir.
Turn your radio down,
hi.
Anthony.
I've heard Rush Limbaugh make this statement about don't participate in the recession. Well, as far as I'm concerned, sir, right now we're in a recession, and I would like to know how he proposes I go about that. I mean, the security company that I've been working for, God forbid, has to give me a pink slip. Do I just tell them, well, that's part of the recession. I'm not participating in that. So I'll be at work tomorrow, and you're going to send me a paycheck.
There's an interesting way of looking at it, but here's the thing, Anthony. Rush doesn't care about you.
Yeah, I mean, just to make a statement like that, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. How do you go about that? If I have, like, an oil company or something, and I increase your, you know, bill because of the recession, are you going to call me and say, well, 2 years ago, my bill was 200. I'm sending you 200. And I'm like, well, Mr. Smith's fly. You're like, well, you're getting two because that increase is part of the recession, and I'm not paying it.
That's a beautiful way of looking at it.
That's if you could, but you can't work it like that.
That is
what he's thinking of.
That's a great way of looking at it. And the reality is the people that he was talking to, they could probably get away with that. You and I, we can't get away with that. I appreciate the call. Thanks so much. Got to turn the radio down. Just a bit.
Go into the. We talked about the Spector situation. Wow. You talk about it on a daily basis. I mean, this is an ongoing
saga. It's a soap opera.
I mean, originally, people were dancing in the aisles. Arlen Specter's changing parties.
Who was dancing in the aisles? I wasn't.
There were some. Oh, I saw them. I mean, they were dancing in the street.
If you remember what I said, I want to see what the details are. I want to see what we gave up in the draft.
Well, I mean, the scenario is it went from that. All of a sudden, the Republican National Committee, and I was surprised that they actually said it. They publicly said, you know, we don't believe that Toomey can win. All of a sudden, they're quoting ex-Governor Ridge. The Republicans were, some of the Republicans were giddy about it. He decides not to run around the same time, actually the next day, because of some of the things Spector said, and he admits it was a mistake. I'm surprised a man around that long said the things he said. He made a mistake saying, you know, he basically hopes Norm Coleman is put in. He said something to the effect that if justice prevails, Senator Coleman will be reinstated as the true senator from Minnesota, who's a Republican. Oops, wrong thing to say. He also made the statement when he was asked on national TV, well, what did you promise the Democratic Party? He says nothing. I promised him nothing.
Yeah.
Then he goes on to say, when they asked him, well, didn't they give you full seniority rights? He made the mistake, I think, from a political standpoint of saying, well, that's a privilege. That's not a right. That doesn't go down well with Democrats who are going to be passed in seniority. So what do the Democrats do? They take that seniority away. Ridge then decides that he's not running. Then we find that the Democrats have capitulated and decided to appoint him as head of a judiciary subcommittee on crime and drugs. And I understand that Senator Dick Durbin was responsible for that, and he kind of backed off on that. Here's the thing.
Didn't I tell you that, though? Didn't I tell you he was gonna get one of those?
Yes, you did. Yes, you did. You are a real man of politics. Right? But truly, what's fascinating is, here's the thing. Of all these developments, the fact that Ridge isn't going to run, I think that's going to entice more Democrats, because if it's Toomey as opposed to Ridge, he's going to be easier to beat. Arlen Specter is not guaranteed the Democratic nomination, not by a long shot. So he's got some real severe problems, and, you know, it's going to be very interesting the next year, Rick.
Yeah, well, let's pick this up on the other side of the break. We're going to take a break. We're right back. 1-877-960-0960. Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. Just like an alcoholic, the first step, I guess, is acceptance. Time magazine this week published an article on the state of the Republican Party. Senator Olympia Snow, Republican from Maine, is quoted saying, "Ideological purity is not the ticket to the promised land." She is echoing comments made by fellow Maine Senator Susan Collins that she made last week. She also complained that, quote, "to the average American, the GOP is just the party of big oil and the rich." Snow recalls that when she proposed fiscally conservative triggers to the Bush tax cuts in case of deficits, she was attacked by fellow Republicans. She said, quote, "I don't know when willy-nilly tax cuts became the essence of who we are to the average American who's struggling. We're in some other stratosphere. We're the party of big business and big oil and the rich." Of course, Americans are right to view the GOP as the party of big oil, which gave nearly $20 million to the Republican Party in the last election cycle. Securities and investment industry, well, they gave the big banks, you know, the ones we're bailing out, they donated more than $54 million to the Republicans. Also in that article, Samuel Wurzelbacher, better known as Joe the Unlicensed Plumber, says he's outraged by the Republicans' overspending and that he's taking his ball and he's going home. He's quitting the party and that he's the bullseye now for its target audience. But he also said that he wouldn't support any cuts to defense, Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid, which along with debt payments would put more than two-thirds of the federal budget completely off-limits, according to Joe the Unlicensed Plumber. And it's no coincidence that many Republicans who voted against the stimulus have claimed credit for the stimulus projects in their districts, which I love. You know, they're against it, but it's benefiting them. So, well, you know, look what I brought in. And Bobby Jindal stopped ridiculing the volcano monitoring programs, especially after one in Alaska went up. So like Snow says, we can't be the anti-government people. That's not what people want. And I agree with her.
There's an extreme example of exactly what we're talking about with the Republican Party, Rick. Right now, the Obama administration is trying to find a replacement for Freeman. We all know the disaster that Mr. Brown was under the Bush administration. And they have nominated the man who headed those kind of operations in Florida. The equivalent of
emergency management
within Florida. He did very well. He went through numerous hurricanes, was considered one of the best. And now there's a congressman from Louisiana running for office, and the Republicans seem to, the conservatives especially, it's a badge of honor just to criticize the Bush administration. So to make himself look good...
You mean the Obama administration?
The Obama administration. I'm sorry. To make himself look good, he's criticizing that appointment. You know, and there was a former moderate congressman from Louisiana that said, this is the kind of thing that's going to destroy our country. He's the antithesis of former head Brown. He's very effective. He has proven himself. And why would you oppose something like that? If, in fact, you think that Louisiana isn't getting enough money, then you need to work with this man and you need to go before Congress and the Obama administration and try to work with him instead of pulling these political stunts. And all that does is turn people off, marginalize people, and people are still leaving the party in groves. And that's a classic example, Rick. Just for political opportunism, you know, they're making these outrageous attacks on the Obama administration. People are saying, you know, you people are a bunch of wing nuts. Well, and they're running away from them as fast as they can.
Well, and that's what the Republican Party has become. They've become the party of no ideas, of no solutions, and of anti-government. And look, at some point, that's not enough, folks. You know, look at what the Bush administration did during their years. That's what happens when you have people who do not believe in government running your government. Was it a surprise that they failed at every opportunity, that they failed at every turn? No, there was no surprise. You know, they're the drown, they're the make government so small that we can drown it in the bathtub crowd.
And again, Rick, on the issue of Katrina, just like a couple other issues, this administration has not answered. Who answered for Katrina, really? Who was held responsible for that horrendous situation where thousands of people died needlessly? It was just a horrendous... You and I, that's why I'm so passionate about it. You and I saw, it's one thing to say 3,000 people plus died. It's another thing to see the reality of it, and we did. In
well,
very
another,
real terms.
It's another thing to see the writing on the wall. I remember when we took the tours when we were down there, and there you remember see the writings on the wall with the big circle with the numbers, the number of people who died in that building, the number of animals who died in that building, and that, I mean, really in and of itself brought it home for me that, you know what, somebody actually had to find those people and pull them out of there, and their last hours were spent that their government had failed them completely.
And when we ran into that Teamster, that African-American Teamster, and he showed us the films that he had taken of the reality of the situation, I mean, it was just horrendous. Should have never, ever, ever happened in the United States of America, but it did.
And
shame on us.
And even years later, he still had burns on his legs and scars on his legs from the chemicals and the oil and all the stuff, that soupy mixture of toxic chemicals that was New Orleans. And he said, you were walking through this sludge, this nasty, toxic sludge. And what did we do? Well, we had Bush and McCain playing guitar and eating cake and having a whole wonderful time.
And Bush telling Brownie, great job.
Heck of a job there, Brownie.
Wow, isn't that nice? If I can touch on that Specter situation quick, Rick, one thing we haven't talked about, you know... Congressman Sustak has announced that, well, he seriously considered it. He hasn't officially announced. You know, I think that puts a lot of pressure on Arlen Specter, especially when it comes to labor issues. You know, I think it's becoming more and more clear to him that if Congressman Sustak has the support of labor, it's going to make his reelection tough. And I think in the West, I think Congressman Sustak would do well. I don't think Arlen Specter would. Even if he survives the primary, I don't think he would do well. I think Congressman Sustak, because of the fact that he is the highest-ranking ex-military officer, a vice admiral, I think that would sell well in the West. He has a good labor record. I think he would be, if he had labor support, would be a very formidable candidate. And I think there's going to be increasing pressure on inspectors to do something about that Employee Free Choice Act.
Well, like we said, without that vote, I mean, you have to be realistic. If you're going to kick labor in the backside, don't expect them to smile and say thank you. Mm-hmm. So there will be no support for Arlen Specter from labor if he does not support their number one legislative priority. I mean, come on. You know, it'd be like, you know, kicking somebody in the behind and saying, "Oh, please, could you do it again? Thank you. Oh, I love that."
Now, I know this is a year away, Rick, but, you know, there's polls being taken. Sustak versus Spector. Spector has won those polls. However, what should be troubling for Arlen Spector is there's a lot of people who aren't sure. There's a lot of people who aren't definite. There's a lot of people who are saying, depending on how he votes on issues like labor issues and health care reform, I could change my mind. So if I was Arlen Spector, that would be troubling to me.
Let me ask you about the poll. What is the question in the poll? Is it a general election or is it the primary election? Because I don't think he gets out of the primary. If he has a tough comp, if he has a somebody like Sestak, a good solid Democrat opposing him, no, does he still poll better in a primary election with Democrats being polled? That's my question.
I think it's for the primary. I definitely think that these polls have asked very relevant questions, Rick. I mean, these are very, very key issues to people. And again, the support, what I'm saying is his support is not that strong. There's a lot of people who would be willing to work to look at a Democrat, and depending on his votes, the support that he has is soft, is what I'm saying.
And considering 10 is an off year, so...
Yes, yes.
So you're going to get he's going to end up getting people who are going to be more against him coming out to the polls than people who would vote for him anyway, I think, in the primary.
I think you're right. I think you're definitely right. And he did not ingratiate himself to too many Democrats with his conduct here.
Yeah, no, he comes out and says, I'm changing to a Democrat. And, oh, by the way, I'm still not in favor of the Employee Free Choice Act. Not a bright move.
I think he has to get off this. He can't be skirting the fence, Arlen.
Nope.
I mean, you either are or you aren't.
That's it. You're either on the team or you're sitting in the stands. We're going to take a break. We're going to come right back with Bob Bruno, Associate Professor of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. We're going to talk about his recent study. We're right back.
Because of the union movement that we've got a 40-hour work week. It's because of the union movement that we've got the minimum wage. It's because of the union movement that we've got benefits like health care and pensions. It's because of the union movement that we got worker safety laws. Even if you're not a member of a union, you benefited from a union.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. A report released this week, a study done by our next guest. He's an associate professor of labor and employment relations at the University of Illinois, has come out with some pretty interesting positions. Bob Bruno, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Walk me through this study you conducted of... I believe it's state workers in Illinois.
This study was a six-year study of the use of majority sign-up authorization, or what has been euphemistically referred to as card check process, to organize workers who are employed with public sector employers. So we're talking state, county, local, municipal, and educational employers. The idea was to take a look at how the provision of the state law passed in 2003 had worked. And so we dug into as many databases as was available and came up with this six-year report.
So what were your results?
Well, the results were pretty astonishing. We were able to discover that over 20,000 public sector workers employed in a multitude of different occupations had been organized through the card check process, and that represented about 1,000 different campaigns, and that the process had worked very efficiently, very smoothly, with very little struggle, very little conflict between the employer and the workers, and that we were particularly interested if there were any cases where the union had been accused of any kind of coercion or fraud in gathering the signatures on the cards. There's an allegation that's been made by opponents of the Employee Free Choice Act that if you were to amend labor law and allow workers to have the option of organizing through a card check, it's a process that is available to them now, but only at the employer's discretion. But if you were to make it something in which the workers chose themselves, that somehow this would lead to abuse and coercion and fraud. Well, we looked at 6 years, and we looked at over 1,000 campaigns, and we did not find a single case confirming any union coercion, intimidation, or fraud. There was one complaint made, but it was found to be groundless. Given the number of cases, and the number of years, the number of employers, the number of workers, it's just astonishing to find such absolute robust findings. The allegations against about coercion and fraud are simply groundless.
So let me ask you, on the other side of this, on the flip side, how many cases of fraud, intimidation, harassment did you find from the employer?
Well, that's a very important question. And it's, I think it's important for people who are thinking about this national legislation and how it will impact the workplace to understand that it has an impact both on the workers and the employer. So when you look at the record, while our principal was concern was to identify cases of union abuse, what we found was that there were very little cases of employer abuse. In fact, it was the number was so minuscule, not to be really statistically relevant. Now, that's not to say that there aren't issues that arise during campaigns, but frankly, this process is not a hostile process, and it's a process that removes the employer, and for it to work appropriately, the employer essentially is required to abide by a set of rules. And the end result of that is that you don't get conflict. You don't get a lot of hostility. You don't get complaints about coercion on either side. But what is worth comparing it to is what happens during election campaigns. So that if you looked at election campaigns over the same time period, the same 6 years, you will see tons, and I don't have the exact number in front of me, but you will see hundreds of complaints made against the employer for violating the electoral process, and likewise, the employer will make allegations against the union. So the so-called secret ballot process, which is not a secret ballot process, but again referred to in shorthand, actually generates a much, much higher rate of complaints and hostility. But the card check process is relatively devoid of conflict.
And isn't that really what we should be moving towards, getting away from this adversarial relationship between workers and their employer? I mean, isn't that the point?
Well, it is. And we know from a lot of just really good survey work that's been done over the past 5 to 6, 7 years, we know that employees who are non-union would like to be union, and a much higher rate indicates support for unionization and would like to join a union, feel a need to join a union. But frankly, they don't hate their employer. They don't want to fight with their employer, and they don't want to risk their job. But there are concerns. There are interests that need to be protected. Unfortunately, current labor law creates a hostile environment. It sets the two parties up as adversaries. There are incentives to fight and to struggle and occasionally to cross the line between what is legal and what is illegal. And frankly, that's not what what employees say they want. And so if you could create nationally an environment by which workers could freely choose to organize, that would be in a non-hostile, rational environment. We're pretty confident, those of us who do this sort of research, that you would create a more harmonious workplace in which both sides would represent their interests, but you would alleviate a lot of the unnecessary conflict that seems to be built in as a result of the current law.
Right. You bring up an excellent point here. I mean, I think it is important to emphasize that nobody wants to go to work and have a hostile work environment. Nobody wants to take on their employer. But, you know, the way things have gone the last 30-plus years, wages have been held down. Profits have skyrocketed, and I think it's important that workers share in the fruits of their labor. And this is how that happens. People collectively bargain. They come to the bargaining table and they say, "Look, we're gonna give you our labor, but we expect something in return."
Well, we know that in the last 20-30 years, really, we can look at these trends change in the early 1970s, where increased productivity and wages begin to diverge. Prior to that, from the 30s through the late 60s, as workers became more productive, their wages went up, and you saw a growing middle-class society. And this period coincides also with a rising number of workers who are unionized and a very strong labor movement, and a time period when all historians would acknowledge, and political scientists and labor relations experts would acknowledge, that labor law was working the way it was supposed to work, and the National Labor Relations Board was working the way it was intended to work. But in the early 1970s, when the Republican Party took a turn towards a more extreme conservative position, and there was considerable business pushback against organized labor, you begin to see productivity and wages then diverge just dramatically. The consequences of that happening is that there's been a growing inequality in society, and there is, in fact, a very pent-up sense of outrage felt by not just union members, but certainly non-union members across the country. And unless we think seriously about some of the regulatory tools like labor law, we're not going to be able to address this sense of outrage, this sense of injustice, and that's certainly going to create more hostile workplaces, and of course, maybe more importantly, it's going to continue. It's going to continue the path that America is on, and that is growing into a more unequal society. So, you know, a bill like the Employee Free Choice Act does become this regulatory mechanism that can help distribute the benefits of productivity and really the benefits of a workplace made up of workers who really want to work with their employers and really do like their jobs, really do care about the work they do, but they understand that they're being exploited and they're going to look for alternatives. And some of those alternatives will be rational and some of them will turn out to be more irrational.
Right. I got to tell you, I think this piece of legislation, I'm kind of disappointed that President Obama hasn't come out and made this the centerpiece of his economic recovery plan. I think this is one of those pieces of legislation that really could honestly and truthfully raise the middle class back up and help to return our economy back to health.
You know, it's good to hear you speak about this legislation as part of an economic recovery plan, and I share your disappointment that he hasn't centralized it, because there's a lot of discussion about growth and focusing on economic policies that generate growth and increase productivity, and that's been the talk over the last 30, 40 years. And that makes sense. That's important to address. But there's the other part, and that's very relevant to building a strong middle class, and that is the distribution of that wealth. Or another way to put it, simply the sharing of the benefits of more skilled workers, a more productive workplace. And we got the productivity piece correct for a while, but the piece we haven't had in place for decades is how do we distribute redistribute that wealth that's being created? How do we make sure that the society more equally people share in the benefits of productivity? And that should be equally an important measurement of an economy's performance. And sadly, the president and too many of his closest economic advisors treat the Employee Free Choice Act or worker rights or union power in the workplace as some kind of an addendum or add-on, but not really understanding that it's key to economic, not just growth, it's key to economic distribution, to wealth being widely shared. And that was something that happened in previous generation. It's not happening now. And it's, I can't imagine how we're going to create broad-based economic demand if we don't find a way to share the wealth, share the profits that are going to be generated as a result of this stimulus package. So it's an open question, and I do think it's a failing of the president's sense of vision, if you will, to not draw these two things closer together.
I'm hoping, I know it was early in his administration, and I'm really hoping that he comes around to it, but I just think this is a key. Can you stick around for the break? Because I want to pick up with something on the other side. Do you have a minute?
Sure, you bet, Rick.
I want to talk about this concept of a meritocracy, because we keep hearing from our right-wing friends that, well, we live in this great meritocracy, and hard work is rewarded. So I want to talk about that on the other side of the break. We're right back.
Think you're so clever, classless and free.
It's class warfare. My class is winning, but they shouldn't be.
But you're still f***ing peasants as far as I can see. Working that...
to the Rick Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. We're here with Bob Bruno, Associate Professor of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois. Bob, I appreciate you taking time, sticking around for us.
You bet.
In the last segment, I asked the question, you know, we talked about the distribution of income, of people sharing in the wealth, but one of the things that this country was founded on was the basis of this, the idea of a meritocracy. You work very hard, you succeed, you get ahead. Every generation does better than the last generation. My children are going to do better than I've done. That's what I believe, but the numbers aren't bearing that out. And I think that's directly proportionate to the idea that we haven't been, as you pointed out, sharing in our productive gains. We're working harder, but we're not sharing in that wealth. Your thoughts?
You make a very good point. In previous generations, there was every expectation that things would get better, that hard work, that commitment to a set of values would lead to a better way of life, and that you would then leave your children a little better off than you were, and that the society would incrementally grow. And in fact, we did see tremendous growth, and one generation did do better than the next generation, and the economy grew forward. But we've now suffered a setback where we see the economy shrinking, and we see a generation not doing as well and threatened. And you have to ask yourself, well, what's changed? Are people's values different now? Are people who are going to work every day looking at their jobs differently? Do they sort of lack the work ethic? And there's simply, you know, no grounds to believe that that people's values are dramatically different, at least those folks who are going into the workplace. But what is changing is the rules of the economy, the rules by which you work and you're rewarded. And the end result is that you find thousands and thousands of workers who deserve significant reward and by all merit standards are very good at what they do. In fact, manufacturing workers in the United States now are the most efficient that they have ever been, yet we're bleeding manufacturing jobs by the millions, and it's pretty clear that that connection between values, hard work, and commitment and reward not just for you but for your larger family, for your community, for your society, has been severed in it. And we can go back and look at the way in which our public policies, our economic policies began to change, particularly in the 70s and through the 1980s, to actually simply, reduce the capacity for the average worker to really benefit from all that hard work. So we've gone from a meritocracy, in which we sort of in a more democratic way distributing this wealth, to a more aristocratic or an aristocracy, to where wealth is now concentrating at the very top. In fact, at levels very similar to what they were in the late 19th century, in the Victorian age, the age of the robber barons. And that's a very, very, very sad and dangerous message to be sending out to young people who are entering the workplace, because no society can stand, frankly, if it doesn't have broad-based distribution of wealth.
I absolutely agree. And let me ask you this. Do you think this piece of legislation is going to be that answer? Because honestly and truthfully, when I read this Employee Free Choice Act a couple years ago, I said right then and there, this doesn't go far enough. If I were to write the legislation, I would have been somebody who was in favor of original intent. Go back to the original intent of the legislation. Workers sign a petition. They sign up. We want to join a union. They're in the union. Either the company negotiates with it for a contract or you go on strike. That's the way it used to be in 1935, and we saw people going to unions in droves. It's only been the last, since the 40s, since Taft-Hartley, that we had this quote-unquote secret ballot process.
You know, it would be foolish to think that one piece of legislation is going to undo the damage of the last couple of decades, that it's going to fully restore a sense of economic justice or what we understood as a countervailing power to corporate greed. But this legislation does put into place at least the conditions upon which workers can, free of employer intervention and abuse, make their own decisions as to how they can best empower themselves. So it's an important piece of legislation, but as you suggest, there are other things that still could be done, and clearly allowing workers to have the capacity and the legal right to withhold their labor seems just actually a basic human right. And so anything that sort of supports the capacity of workers not to be compelled to work when they're being abused, frankly, will go a long way to restoring a sense of economic democracy. But other broad-based legislation in which we use public policy to provide health care, a universal health care plan, would be very, very important to this process. And clearly, taking a strong look at trade policy will be relevant, and a more expansive job retraining policy. So there's lots of public policy pieces to this puzzle, and the Employee Free Choice Act becomes a mechanism by which, if you've got all those policies in place, or you begin to institute some of those policies, then the benefits of growth, if you will, and productivity will be more widely distributed. So it is a package, frankly. You need to start somewhere. But I wouldn't disagree with your notion that it may not be sufficient enough to sort of get us back to a place where we really can feel that America is a more egalitarian society.
Right. I would have liked to have seen some strike replacement language put in.
Yeah. There you go.
So that, you know what, the workers and the employer, they're going to come to terms. They're going to, one way or another, they're going to work things out. Last question before we take a break here. This study that I'm assuming it has been vehemently attacked by the right wing.
Well, this study that we did on Illinois is the first of a couple of reports. We're going to look at a number of other states, too. We're going to try to come out with something that looks at the use of a card check process or something like it in a number of other states, and we'll see what sort of reactions we get. But so far, there haven't been any obvious attacks that I'm aware of. I can sort of expect what most people's concerns might be or questions or criticisms might be. But frankly, it's pretty hard, I think, to challenge 6 years of data collected by a government body in an archive when the data is there, when the evidence is there, when it's very, very clear and objective. To deny it, it is either to declare yourself a fool or a rabid ideologue. So I sort of welcome people's critique of it because, frankly, I think a little bit of sunlight and a little bit of evidence, a little bit of hard data brought to bear on this issue would go a long way in maybe trying to persuade some fence sitters to where they stand on this issue, and maybe some folks who've sort of flip-flopped a bit about where they stand on it. So I would sort of welcome people wanting to come in and take a look at the records in Illinois. I think they're going to be just as astonished as I was and the team of people who were doing the research here.
Well, I'll tell you what I did. I put a stamp on it, and I sent it off to Senator Arlen Specter's office for him to read. Hopefully he takes a look at it. And if any of our listeners want to read the report, just go to thericksmithshow.com, click on Bob Bruno's name. It will take you right to the report. You can read for yourself exactly what he has to say. Bob, I appreciate you taking time for us.
It was a pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a break right here. 1-877-960-0960. We're right back.
Making better flowers. Right off the boat from Finland. To live in the land of the free.
Work all your life, what do you get? $10 richer and 20 in debt. You can have anything if you can pay. Don't miss your due date or we'll take it away. Credit, credit, credit card. You can have anything with a MasterCard. Buy now, pay later, do it today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. President Obama will be holding town hall meetings this coming week in New Mexico to promote congressional efforts to reform credit card practices, according to the White House. Banks such as Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Capital One Financial face a new set of rules issued by the Federal Reserve last year aimed at reining in abusive credit card practices. The rules are to be implemented by July of 2010, a date some lawmakers and consumer groups complain is too far into the future to help struggling consumers. Legislative efforts are aimed at stopping credit card companies from imposing certain late fees, restrictive retroactive rate increases, and also their questionable billing practices and marketing to minors. Now, get this. This is what caught my eye. In 2007, Jake, there were 694.4 million, 694.4 million credit cards with Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover logos. Almost 700 million credit cards. There are only 300 million people in this country, Jet. Stop and think about that for a second. The amount, the number of credit cards, and we talked about this a couple weeks ago. This is how Americans have supplemented their income. This is how we've kept our standard of living. Almost 700 million credit cards. And you might as well cut a third of those out, because those are kids under 18. So you're talking almost every working person in this country's got three credit cards, if not more.
And it's a little bit like the mortgage crisis. They entice you They entice you with this 0%. 0% for to a certain date. A lot of people buy into it, and of course the credit card companies assume, and in many instances correctly, that you're going to spend, and when that date comes, you're going to go from 0% to whatever, and it's usually, it could be anywhere from 9 all the way up to 19%, and then they got you. And here's another troubling, and I didn't believe it, but you know, the more we talk about it, I do believe the fact they said, of the people who have credit cards, on average, Rick, on average, they have 7. 7 credit cards.
I've got 1.
You're very much in the minority.
And I don't have a balance. I pay my balance every month.
And you are very much in the minority.
Well, there's a reason for that, Jake. I've got a decent paying job.
That's right.
A decent paying union job.
Well, plus you have your spending priorities. You can have a good income and still be caught in the credit crunch, too.
Yes and no, but for the most part, people get themselves into trouble because they bought groceries, they put gas,
right.
You know, they bought school clothes for their kids. That's the biggest part of it. And then they get stuck paying, you know, 15, 18, 20% interest on these credit cards. And then you never get out from under that. I saw the one when we were talking about changing the credit card rules a couple years ago. 47 years to pay off credit card balance by just making the minimum payments. 47 years. There's something wrong there.
And they do make it easy for you, and it's very, very enticing. But you said it right, too. Then you have the economic crisis. And you have people who lost their jobs, who maybe have, they might have unemployment if they're lucky. They might even lost their unemployment. And the only place they have to go to get money immediately is their credit cards.
And, you know, I got to tell you, I think it gets much worse here this December 31st. When the rate caps come off the electric industry, you know, I'm looking at my financial situation. I'm going, can I afford 30, 40, 50% rate increases on my electric bill?
No.
I don't think so. And, you know, I look at people who are making minimum wage and, you know, $8-$10 an hour. How are they going to get by? You know, we're now throwing them to the wolves, saying, well, you know, whatever the market dictates. But there are no alternatives for you. We've monopolized the energy industry. And
well, and again, the oversight hasn't been there, Rick. I mean, when you allow a credit card company, on their own whim, from information that they get from other sources, to up your percentage to as much as 33%, my God, that's just legalized larceny. I mean, I don't find any difference between someone robbing me at gunpoint and the credit card companies, to be honest, at certain times.
Yeah. Well, this new credit card bill of rights, I think some of it's a step in the right direction. It's moving us, I think, towards ending some of these abusive practices. I know one time they got my payment late. I do all my bill paying online. So when I clicked the little thing, they credited it an hour late. So they charged me $39. And then they charged me interest on the balance for 2 months. There's something seriously wrong there. They charged me interest on the balance, then they took that interest over to the next month, and they charged me interest on that interest. That is wrong. That is just flat out wrong. And of course, I canceled that card the day they did that.
Have you contacted a credit card company lately, Rick? I mean, every time you talk to them, for instance, I thought I lost one of my credit cards, so I called them and canceled it.
Hello.
And I got the new ones.
Hello, my name is Bub.
Yeah, well, not only that, yeah, you know, Mahatma, who says his name is Bub, was really calling me, probably from India and Pakistan or wherever.
They'll be honest with you. They'll tell you, ask.
He certainly wasn't in the economy of the United States. The point is, all I wanted to do was call them and say, look, you know, I want my credit card. These are my numbers, blah, blah. Well, they tried to sell me 4 or 5 different things.
Yeah.
I said, finally, I had to say, look, Bub, all I want is my credit card activated. That's all.
That credit protection thing is such a scam.
Oh, my. I mean, he was going on and on and on, and it was several other things. I finally had to tell him, look, all I want is you to activate my card.
But, you know, the thing is this new piece of legislation that they're talking about, I think is some steps in the right direction. We're going to end some of the gimmicks, some of the due date changes. We're going to, you know, end some of the real abusive things that are going on, and unfair penalties for cardholders who pay on time. This double cycle billing, like I was just talking about, common sense. But what's happened is these credit card companies have done a masterful job of lobbying our government, making regulations, making rules that benefit them over us, and all while we weren't paying attention, while we were debating gay marriage, while we were debating abortion. And this is, we talk about this all the time. This is the important stuff. If you're against gay marriage, if someone asks you to marry them, say no. Say thanks, but I don't go that way. If you're against abortion, don't have one. This is the kind of stuff that hurts all of us. And I hope people are waking up to this fact that, the curtains are being drawn back. We're starting to see now, thanks to the Obama administration and really this economic crisis, just how one-sided this entire process, this whole economic process has been. The banking industry has controlled this country, and every time it steals too much, every time it makes a mistake, where do they turn? They turn to you and me. And they extract fees and penalties and all of this money out of our pocket. When we talked to Greg Smith, the president of PSECU, a couple weeks ago, he came out and said, look, the credit card industry, because of these changes, are going to lose $10 billion. You know where that $10 billion comes from, Jake? It comes from you. It comes from me. It comes from our listeners. And you know what? The heck with them. That's our money. We should be able to keep it.
You are so, so right. The very people who are getting excoriated and just ripped off by the credit card industry, instead of calling your congressman and saying, I want something done, they're calling your congressman and making a comment about gay marriage. And we make the mistake, and I think I might be one of them, of assuming after this election, because the Democrats are in charge, that things are automatically going to change. They're not, because at the end of the day, it's about money, whether you're talking about credit card reform, and as we're finding out, to our big disappointment, when it comes to health care reform, the vested interests are very powerful, and they are there. They are talking to the congressman every day, and they're throwing oceans of money at these legislators. So the rank and file citizen of this country has to do their democratic duty and contact their senators, contact their congressmen, tell them what you want to do on these important issues. That's what's important, not these side issues, these divisive issues. And if we do that, it can be effective, but we have to get off our duffs.
Well, I mean, you look at this week when Governor John Podolsky, governor of Maine, signed the marriage equity law, becoming the fifth state to allow same-sex marriage on the Christian Broadcasting Network. Pat Robertson responded by claiming that this was the ultimate conclusion of legalizing same-sex marriage. What it would do is it was the legalization of polygamy and bestiality and child molestation and pedophilia. He said, you mark my words, this is just the beginning of a downward slide, the end of the world is coming. Are you kidding me? And you know, the thing is this guy has built a billion-dollar media empire. People actually listen to this nonsense. I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, don't think for one minute he wasn't looking at contributions from his true believers, Rick. Stir them up. And stir the pot.
And you look at Alan Keyes. Alan Keyes this week gets arrested at Notre Dame, which was purely a political stunt. Where was Alan Keyes when the priests were molesting kids? Why wasn't Alan Keyes out there protesting that?
It's no wonder that Obama, I think, beat him something like 75-25.
I think it was more than that. I thought it was like 80.
I mean, it was embarrassing.
It was embarrassing.
It was embarrassing.
Because he's a nutcase. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll wrap this up next. 1-877-960-0960. according to a new Pew poll per CNN, churchgoers are more likely to back torture of suspected terrorists. More than half of the people surveyed who attend church at least once a week, 54%, said the use of torture against suspected terrorists is often or sometimes justified, while only 42% of people who seldom or never go to church services agreed, according to this analysis by the Pew Forum on Religious and Public Life. White evangelical Protestants, they were the group most likely to say they were in favor of torture, and 60% of them supported it. People unaffiliated with any religious organization at all were the least likely to support torture. Only 40% of them supported it. And true to form, our right-wing loudmouth, Sean Hannity, he has not gone forward with his fundraising plan, even though he has a base of donors just waiting to send their money to support the troops. You may remember Mr. Big Mouth himself, Sean Hannity, on April 22nd, volunteered to be waterboarded. He defended the practice of waterboarding, tore into President Obama for ending its use, and then he went on and on about how Obama wasn't keeping us safe and how waterboarding's not torture and blah, 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 blah. And here we are, 2 weeks later, and nothing. Not another peep came out of Sir Tough Guy, Sir Defender of the Troops. And Keith Olbermann himself has offered $1,000 per second. Per second, if Hannity's waterboarded. Now, you look at the 2005 torture memo written by Stephen Bradbury. Required the CIA to have a tracheotomy kit on hand to revive a detainee who had effectively drowned. Directly from this memo, quote, a detainee could suffer spasms of the larynx that would prevent him from breathing even when the application of water is stopped and the detainee is returned to an upright position. In the event of such spasms, a qualified physician would immediately intervene to address the problem, and, if necessary, the intervening physician would perform a tracheotomy. We are informed that the necessary emergency medical equipment is always present, although not always visible by the detainee, during the application of waterboarding. The memo warns, quote, for reasons of physical fatigue or physiological resignation, the subject may simply give up, allowing excessive filling of the airwaves, and aggressive medical intervention may be required to restore breathing. Yet, Mr. Big Mouth himself, Hannity, continues to say, it's not drowning. And you got O'Reilly saying, oh, it's just a splash of water in the face. So, when's he going to do this, Jake? When is Sir Big Mouth going to submit himself to just a little splash in the face? Just a little water? Just a little water, like when you were kids. You used to have water balloon fights, right?
You know, maybe somebody can make money on that, Rick. You know, sell tickets, you know.
I'd buy a ticket. Yeah, I'd love to see him be waterboarded.
Let's rent a Giant Center, see if we can make money on that. I'd pay money to see that.
Not just because I don't like the guy. Not just because I'd love... Well, I mean, there's the good thing about it is you put on pay-per-view, there's that feeling that maybe he could die.
I think you'd have takers on that.
I'd buy it.
We'll
even though it might only be a second.
That might be a good project. We'll promise to give the money to charity.
Well, that's what he said. He said he'll whatever money he raises from him being waterboarded, he was going to give to the troops. And you know, Sean Hannity so loves the troops that he's going to put himself in harm's way. But it's been 2 weeks and not another peep, not another mention of it since then.
That begs a question, Rick, and I don't know the answer. Maybe you do. You know, Mr. Patriot, did he ever serve in the Army? Did
no.
he ever serve, period?
No.
Never volunteered?
No.
A little bit like five deferments Cheney, perhaps?
Or Limbaugh. I mean, but I can't say anything. I didn't join the military either.
So he's another chicken hawk.
Well, yeah. It's interesting how those who are willing to put others' people in jeopardy are the ones out there fighting vehemently to defend Bush's policies.
And the most outspoken against the war and the most effective were those who have been there, who have been in contact, who have led men who know how horrible war is. And those are the ones who opposed our war because they know that we were making a tragic mistake. And a lot of them, you know, and God bless them, a lot of them had the courage and the integrity to know that they were going to give up their career doing it, but yet they spoke up because they felt morally compelled.
You know, it's one of those things. You got to question someone who's willing to come out and say, "Yep, I think torturing people is good." Yet I'm a Christian.
That's crazy.
I mean, that's the part that really gets me. 60% of evangelical Christians. These are the people who follow Christ, who by all accounts was a pacifist. How can you justify? I mean, help me with this, because I don't understand. How is it possible that someone who follows someone who was a pacifist believes that torture is okay? Love thy neighbor as thyself. Do unto others. What happened to that? Well, the terrorists are out to get us!
Unfortunately, they bought into that. I mean, let's be honest with Hannity. You know, does he really believe that? I mean, what he's trying to do is put a black mark on the Obama administration, saying, oh, they're opposing it. Look what he's doing. He's putting the country at risk.
He puts Dijon mustard on his hamburger!
That's crazy stuff.
Isn't that insane?
Absolutely.
You're going to beat up the guy because he puts mustard on his hamburger? That's the best they can come up with? The fact that he wants some spicy mustard on his hamburger? That is the best that Fox News can do? Boy, I tell you, here again, the Republican Party completely void of any ideas. They are lost in the wilderness.
Or they criticize Mrs. Obama because of what she wears. For instance, just lately she got the wives of some of the congressmen, senators together, and they went out and worked in soup kitchens, which I think is great. Absolutely.
Eleanor Roosevelt.
And they criticized her. Well, she didn't wear the appropriate attire. I mean, come on, let's get real here. I mean, it's crazy.
What's the appropriate attire?
Well, you tell me. I mean, you know, what are you supposed to do? Cut up your clothes in rags or something? I mean, it's just silly, almost childish stuff, Rick. I mean, if I were them, on a national syndicated radio show, if that's the best I could do, I would be embarrassed.
I mean, here again, and you know, we didn't get a call today from Brad O'Leary, extreme right wing mouthpiece. We were expecting, well, I wasn't, but you know, his people said he was gonna call in, it didn't happen. And here again, it's one of these situations where they control the media. And they project this image of, well, it's the great liberal media out there. There's a liberal media bias. Yet they're the ones in control of the media. They're the ones controlling the message. When Rush Limbaugh, Mr. $400 million contract, defender of corporate America, has the power to go on 600-700 radio stations across this country and get people to act against their own best economic interests, there's a problem with democracy. There's a problem with the structure of our media. Because there are no alternative voices, Jake. I drive in areas across this country. There are no dissenting voices from the right-wing message. There's nothing. There's a void.
Yeah.
And the reality is Limbaugh, these radio stations don't pay Limbaugh for his program. He gives it to them. Here, put it on. Put it on 1,000 stations. Put it on every station. And these small stations who are struggling to make a profit, they put it on. Because it's free. Limbaugh's supported by these big think tanks. He's supported by huge multinational corporations. Do you think he's really going to come out and say, well, we need workers need rights? Do you think he's ever going to come out and say workers need health care? Do you think he's ever going to come out and say, you know, unemployment insurance doesn't support a family during the time of need? Is he ever going to come out and say, you know what, food stamps are a good investment in our community because it feeds our kids, it stops disabilities, it stops kids from regressing intellectually?
The sad part about it is, Rick, the very people that would benefit by these programs are persuaded to oppose those programs by Rush. It just defies logic sometimes. And to show you how powerful Rush is, I mean, Eric Cantor, who's the House Majority, all he wanted to do, he wanted to take a tour of the country and talk to the American people and find out what's on their mind. What's wrong with that, Rush? Rush opposes that. Well, if the Republican Party was smart, that's exactly what they would do. They would find out the concerns, the fears, what the American people are concerned about, and then come back and talk about the issues and come up with rational, common sense, middle of the road policies that address those issues. And Rush says that's wrong. What's wrong with that? Nothing.
Or at least give the appearance that you care, one way or another. Anyway, we're going to be back tomorrow. Remember, check out the website at therickssmithshow.com. We look forward to hearing from everybody again tomorrow. I want to thank our guests, Bob Bruno from the University of Illinois and James Salt from Catholics United. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking with Mike Byrne, Heather Boucher, and Richard Vogel. Interesting program on the tap for tomorrow. Keep informed, keep in active. We'll see you tomorrow.
It's come through a hole in the air from those nads in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Thanks for lending an ear.
Oh, there's no hurry. Tonight he'll be at Rick's. Everybody comes to Rick's.
I've already heard about this cafe and also about Mr. Rick himself.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine. Was that your plan?
Oh, just a little something on my own.
Oh, stop it. You know what I want to hear.
No, I don't.
You played it for her, you played it for me.
Well, I don't think I can remember.
If she can stand it, I can. Play it.
Welcome to Rick's Place. We are open and ready. Here's the proprietor of Rick's and Horn's psychotherapist, Rick Goodner.
Howdy, Rangers. This is Rick Goodner. You're at Rick's Place here on Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. Oh, my goodness, what a tough week it's been. Kind of fun, but tough anyway. You guys just belly on up to the bar. Ladies, sit over there at that table. Take it easy. And you sit over there in the back where you're at. Keep watching people as they come in. I know what you're doing. You're dissecting everything that's going on. You're looking at the people coming in. You're listening to what's being said. And you're studying people. Rick's Place is the best place to do that because we have all kinds here. And some of the kinds that we're going to have today are some Republican nuts. Some cool stuff. I'll have a few clips for you today, and then we'll do a little bit of commentary on them, and we'll go from there. But before that, a little housekeeping. This is listener-supported radio. Don't forget to make your contributions. You don't. I promise you, one day you're going to wake up, and there will be no head-on radio. Bob receives no support from any left-wing organizations. None of the liberal rich people give a penny, so if you want to keep this going, you got to make your contributions. Let's keep things moving, and moving we are. Remember, it was the horn who has pointed out things before any of the other systems picked them up, before the blogs, before any of the so-called liberal, I'm sorry, they are called progressive radio stations, picked up information. So if you want to get up-to-date stuff, you have to get it here. If you want to get unfiltered and maybe a little bit of raving, get it from me because I'm completely unfiltered and I do rave. It's that divine insanity that I have, too. I love it. Today's going to be a bit of potpourri. We're going to look at a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I don't think I'll give you a recipe like I did once before, but, we may even talk about a little bit of food. I promise you there'll be plenty of food for thought. And, you know, we had the thrashing around of people who are scared to death, the Republicans. Their party is completely falling apart. Oink, oink. Excuse me. Got a little cough there. Anyway. They're still thrashing about. They're scared to death. They don't know for sure what they're going to do. And so they're going back to their old playbook that's, you know, worked for them before, back when insanity completely went through this place. And they're kind of working on that. They're scared to death of prosecution for their crimes. They really are. And, of course, they're coming out, like I talked about last week, and saying stuff like, well, the Democrats were involved, too. It's their fault. They were involved. But not in the way that you said, John Cornyn. The way they were involved was they did not impeach Bush. They did not start investigations. They did not start the criminal procedures that needed to be done to clean up you stupid, crooked, horrible people. So now, you conservatives, you retardicans are thrashing about trying to prove to everybody that everything's good. And it's kind of working. I mean, we got polls showing that 60% of the people in America do not want prosecution of the torturers. They don't. Nor the people who wrote the memos. They don't. Nor do they want prosecution of Bush. Okay, let's take a look at that 60%. I broke down once before how we have in this country left-wing people and right-wing people. And then everything we have in the center are just spineless people who will go towards the direction that the wind's blowing. If the wind is blowing to the right, they're to the right. If it's blowing from the left, they're to the left. Because they have no internal convictions. Now, if you're looking at the solid Republicans in the Republican Party, you're looking at about 30% of the population who vote. So, half of that 60% are Republicans. The other half of the 60% are the middle of the roaders, the people who were voting and supporting the Republican Party, the Fox watchers and listeners. And although they want the economy fixed by the Democrats, and although they want to make sure that they get to keep their job, thank you, Democrats, they still have this conservative mindset, which to me means we still have 30% of the population that needs to be bitch-slapped. Sorry, guys, just my way of looking at things. Because they haven't yet had it processed through their little minds that they have been voting against their own best interests. And part of the proof is that still those 30% do not want any retribution for those criminal, horrible war criminals. And here is the main reason why. They were a part of it. You must understand that if you're to understand anything else in this world. That 30%, those middle of the roaders, let it happen. They voted them in. They sat back and said, I'm closing my eyes. You do whatever you want. Just protect me. Just protect me. Protect me, please. Protect me. And so, the delusion, not even the illusion, but the delusion of protection was put forth. They bought into it, and they supported it. This makes them guilty. This makes them guilty. A little fact that I don't mind pointing out to every retardican that I know, and I do, and I really do quite often. So if there's an investigation, and if it shows that Bush and the Republican Party were guilty of torture, which they are, then that means the middle of the roaders, the people who bend whichever the way the wind's blowing, they're just as guilty as the Republican Party. They're just as guilty as the attorney you, Bibee. They're just as guilty as Condoleezza Rice. They're just as guilty as George Bush. They're just as guilty of the rank and file CIA members who actually did the torturing. So no, they don't want an investigation because it's going to show their guilt. So it must be forced upon them. And when it happens, they are going to start running for the hills. Oh, I was a Republican. I didn't have anything to do with that. I never voted for him. If they actually have trials going, the middle of the roaders are going to back off, and suddenly there's going to be nobody that ever voted for a Republican. It's going to be an anomaly. No one's going to be able to understand it. How did Bush get in office? How did the Republicans take control of the Supreme Court? How did the Republicans take control of Congress if no one voted for them? It's kind of the reverse of after World War II in France. Suddenly, every Frenchman was in the resistance. Every one of them. None of them collaborated with the Germans. They were all in the resistance. Well, the fact of the matter is, if all the French citizens were in the resistance, the Nazis could not have stayed in France. They could not have done it. Bring that forward, because I am a student of history. Bring that forward to today. If all of the people who are now denying that they voted for George Bush really did not vote for George Bush and the retardicans, Bush would not have got into office. Bush would not have got into office. Neither would the Republicans have taken over both houses of Congress. This is a simple fact. So how did the Retardican leadership get these middle-of-the-roaders to vote for them? Well, they scared them to death. And now they're starting to do it again. There is this most disgraceful, most dishonest, most horrid video that the House Republicans have put out. And I'm going to play for you in a second. Listen to the scary music in the background. I'm sorry you can't see the images, but go on YouTube and look it up. It's there. They put out a video that is showing all these horrifying things. They even have pictures of 9/11 in it. They have a few more pictures. They have Obama giving the ghetto handshake to Chavez. They have Obama bowing to the Saudi prince. They have pictures of Obama with the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Ooh, they're brown people. Let's all be afraid. Let's be afraid. Let's be afraid. God, they're honorable congressmen, and they're making them out to be something to be afraid of. Just like Fox News is now running these stupid so-called news saying that this is some kind of Mexican flu that was brought over here, and it's because our borders are porous and people are coming in. They missed the fact that the flu was first brought to this country by American citizens, members of a church school who went to Cancun for a holiday, and they brought it back. But these homophobic, xenophobic, freedom-phobic fools will put up anything they can to scare these spineless creatures in the middle. That's what they're doing, and they're doing it again. I want you to listen to this. I may say a few words after, and I know you'll probably hear me retching here in a bit because I'll be throwing up watching this garbage again, but this is what they do. This is what they do, and it works. It works. Give a good listen.
What is the administration's overarching plan to take on the terrorist threat and to keep America safe?
President Obama's decision to close Guantanamo Bay has ignited a debate, especially over the issue of where to put those prisoners.
The real question that we now face is, what is President Obama's strategy to confront this threat from radical jihadists?
Teaching our enemies our armaments by taking techniques off the table, we have made it more difficult in a whole host of circumstances I can imagine, more difficult for CIA officers to defend the nation.
Memos. His own director of national intelligence, Dennis Blair, released this two-page memo in which basically he privately distributed to intelligence officials, said in this two-page memo, quote, high-value information came from interrogations in which those methods were used and provided a deeper understanding of the Al-Qaeda organization that was attacking this country.
Did that scare you? Did that make you pee your pants? Well, if it didn't, congratulations. You're not a retardican, and you're not a middle-of-the-road, spineless, scared rabbit. That was garbage, but it's going to work. It's going to work. It's going to work. It's going to work. The images they put in there, my goodness, Obama's making you unsafe. Obama's going to get you killed. On Huffington Post, I have a connection to my Facebook. And whenever I make a comment, it sends it directly over to Rick Goodner Facebook. So you can always read my comments there. But one of the things that I thought of when I was listening to that garbage was that it really works because 21% of the people in America are cowards, yellow belly cowards. They would fall on their knees to any dictator that promised not to hurt them, that promised to take care of them. and they are scared to death of everything in life. And when the Republicans put out garbage like this, it scares them even more deeply. This is a sad state of affairs in America, where you have 20% of the voters in America who are cowards, blazing cowards, scared to move, scared to death. And I'm going to be honest with you guys, the only reason why they're supporting the Democrats at this point is because they're more afraid of the fact that they are going to go broke because of the retardicans and the conservative mindset than they are of terrorists at this moment. But that's going to change. When things start to get good, they're going to go back to the conservatives because they are paranoid and afraid. And they want someone to protect them. The statement I made in Huffington Post is, and I really believe it, that the Republicans cannot wait for another terrorist attack. They're praying for it. No, don't give me this crap about Republicans are good Americans. They wouldn't want other Americans to die just for their political party. Well, that's bullshit. If you believe it, you're a moron. They want to win and they want to control no matter if you die. They want another attack on the mainland, and they want it under Obama. And they want this 21% of cowards to come running to them and put them back into power. They're expecting it. They're praying to their God for it. They want us to get hit. They want 3,000 more Americans to die. They want it. You're a fool if you don't believe it. They want it, and they want to get back in power that way. That's why they keep hanging on to this stupid system that they have. Because when, if God helps them, and we do get hit, the 21% in the middle will run back to them. And they will. They will. And then the retardicans start saying, well, we told you so, we told you so, we got to torture. We got to be monsters. Okay, it's okay. Yeah, go ahead and torture them. I don't care. Just don't let me get hurt. Please don't let me get hurt. You go ahead and torture them, you kill them. Whatever it takes, just don't let me get hurt. I can abide by a lot of stuff in the world. I take a lot of garbage in the world. But the one thing, the only thing, that I absolutely will not condone in front of me or around me is cowardliness. There isn't a worse creature in the world than a coward. If you are so afraid that you are going to personally get hurt, that you will give up every liberty guaranteed by your liberal founding fathers, you don't deserve that liberty, nor do you deserve that protection. If we have to make ourselves into monsters, if we have to make ourselves as bad as the terrorists, we're not in a good place. I remember once my mother saying something about a story she was reading, and she just looked up from it and says, a brave person dies once, but a coward seems to die a thousand deaths. Well, she was a genius. I was a little kid. I could take that in, and I thought, she's right. My mother is the most intelligent person in the world. She came up with the truest statement in the world. A brave person dies once, but a coward dies a thousand deaths. Because every time they're afraid, they die a little bit. Everybody should think their mother is a genius, by the way. And even though I found out years later that she was just repeating an old saying that she heard before, she's still a genius to have said it. I cannot abide a coward. No one enjoys pain, but if you're afraid of pain and you're willing to give up everything to stop pain, You don't deserve the lack of pain. If you are a coward and you're willing to give up all your freedoms to be protected, you don't deserve freedom. If you think, because you are such a coward, that America should be monsters and torture and abuse, you don't deserve to be an American. Got that, middle of the roaders? Do you understand what I'm saying? You have no place in America, the home of the brave, if you're such a coward. That I do believe. Pure and simple. Now, my belief systems does not invade your belief systems, and you're allowed your own. That's what I put myself up as. That's what I make sure that I uphold in life. No matter how scary a situation is, I'm not going to be a coward in that situation. If I have to give up everything I own and everything I love, I can make that trade for freedom and justice and what is right in the world. If I must die so that you can keep your freedom, I will smile on the way towards my death. That's me. That's how I think. I cannot stand a coward. To be a coward is to be the most self-centered creature in the world. To be a coward makes you into a monster willing to destroy others for your own sense of safety. Being a coward turns the world over to monsters, and the world does abound with monsters everywhere. Everywhere. They are there, and they are evil, and they are going to make you think they're going to protect you as long as you let them do their evil stuff. But listen up, coward. Listen up, you retardicant cowards. If you turn the monsters loose upon those that you are afraid are going to hurt you, you have just turned the monster loose upon yourself. If you fear so deeply for your life, liberty, and safety that you will let a monster do nefarious, horrible deeds to protect you, they will turn on you and do it to you. Every coward is constantly tortured. Every coward is constantly tortured. That gives you no right, retardicant cowards, to choose to allow other humans to be tortured because you don't have the backbone, the strength, or the courage to not torture yourself with your own cowardliness. My point on the issue is simple. If you are a coward, do not suffer us your existence, you coward.
I'm trying to tell you, but your eyes don't close. What is going Dies, a thousand deaths. A soldier dies, but once.
You live your life with heaven's man. You
be it, my little rangers. Cowards and liars. Liars and cowards. That's the whole kit and caboodle of the Retardican Party and the middle of the roaders, who can't make up their mind which way they want to lean, which way they want to bend their knees. They just go with the flow. Whichever the way the wind blows, that's the way they're going to kowtow to whomever scares them the most. I like the last part of the song, the very last word. Liars. Retardicans are liars. That's like saying snow is cold. I'm sure there's some relativity to that. Snow is cold. Snow is cold. There is a temperature that snow stays at, I guess. But snow is still snow. Cold is still cold. Liars are still liars. Republicans are still liars. All makes sense to me. All makes sense to me. Here's another thing that can make sense to you. Listen to this little statement from a friend of mine. It's from Elaine Decker, and she says, did you see her informative chemistry lesson on CO2 last week? Nice question. And then she asked, why do they even allow her to speak anymore? Wondering who she's talking about? Well, if you tuned in last week, you heard about the CO2 thing. But then she goes on, our friend, Ms. Decker, goes on and says, actually, perhaps we should be pushing a Pollan-Bachman 2012 ticket. And I replied, I love your thoughts on the Pollan-Bachman 2012 ticket. Nuts should be housed together. So I guess you don't have any problem at all understanding that the person that we're talking about is, of course, Michelle Bachman. She's done it again, guys. They let her in front of a microphone again. Oh, my God, this girl, she is so much fun. So dearly proud to have her around. I'm going to now let you listen to a little newscaster talking some to about what Miss Bachman said as of late, and let you hear Miss Bachman, and then the newscaster come back on and say her little bit, and then we will do our little dance of joy around her. Here we go.
And Congresswoman Michelle Bachman back in the news again for some controversial comments she made trying to suggest that there was a link between swine flu and Democrats.
I find it interesting that it was back in the 1970s that the swine flu broke out then under another Democrat president, Jimmy Carter, and I'm not blaming this on President Obama. I just think it's an interesting coincidence.
And that would be an interesting coincidence, except swine flu happened in 1976, and the president at the time was a Republican president, Gerald Ford.
Isn't that neat? What's really neat is that these fools are starting to get called on it. Not much. We must understand that. They're not being called much on it. But occasionally a newscaster will call the liars for their liars. And I guess for Bachman it's easy because she just ain't right. That girl just ain't right. So anyway, there you go. I'm not blaming Obama for the swine flu. But isn't it interesting? Isn't it interesting that Carter was president for the first swine flu and now Obama is? Let us think about that. Now, who is that going to? No, for one thing, she's crazy. No two ways about it. And she gets all of her information from the information that Rush Limbaugh pulls out of his ass. So, you know, you can't expect much out of her. But there are people who listen to this stuff all the time who's going to go, oh, my God, yes, they're out to get us. It's obvious. Carter had swine flu in America, and now Obama, my God, and Obama doesn't have a birth certificate. Oh, my God. You know, it's just pure insanity, pure insanity. You know, back when I first started into this field, the only real paranoid insanity that I had to put up with was this constant idea from the right that the world was being controlled by Jews. Jews poisons the water well. Jews creates diseases. Jews has an international conspiracy to control your money. But now, thanks to Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, that bastard, Bill O'Reilly, Beck, and all the other crazy right-wing people and all of Fox News, they've got the Democrats as being the scapegoat for everything that went wrong. Well, as a newscaster pointed out rightly, it was Gerald Ford who was there. I remember standing in line and going and get my oink-oink shot with all the other Americans, which, by the way, we didn't have an outbreak. And there was people complaining after that, by the way. I went down, I got my shot, and then this pig flu didn't get anybody. It just didn't happen in America. And I'm over there going, well, and the problem is, well, I shouldn't have had to get the shot. Because no place in America did they have this flu going out and getting people. And I'd always say, do you think maybe the fact that everybody received the shots, and so they had an immunity against the flu, may have helped? Paranoid people have trouble with that kind of reasoning. But I think Stephen Colbert did it the best. He went back and he said, okay, yep, absolutely for sure. It was Carter's fault the first time, and it is now Obama's fault this time. And by obvious understanding of how things go, if a president is in control during the time of an outbreak of a pandemic, then obviously it's his fault. So he put up a little chart, and he showed Bush 2 and said, Bush 2, bird flu. Then he shows another little picture on the chart, Bush 2, SARS. Oh, my goodness. Anyway, and he goes through this little chart, and then he gets all the way to the back to Reagan. And he goes, Reagan, AIDS. So here you are with all these Republican presidents on this nice little chart and these horrible diseases right next to them. So, obviously, if Carter, which wasn't there at the time, and Obama created the pig flu, then all of the horrible diseases that happened under Republicans had to be Republicans' fault, all the way to AIDS. Yes, even to AIDS. My, my, my. Hilarious. I didn't want to go through the whole thing. I want you to watch it. You can get this on fancast.com. Do a search for the Colbert Report. Get the one, I believe it's for 43009, maybe 42909, and watch it. It is absolutely hilarious. Which brings me to another issue. There's been a research done that shows that liberals tend to really enjoy Stephen Colbert. We enjoy his irony and sarcasm. We can see how he is making himself out to be like a Bill O'Reilly, pulling garbage out of his butt and feeding it to people. Now, Colbert does it very well. This guy is hilarious. And the research showed that when the liberals saw it, they thought it was funny. And they believed that he was making fun of conservatives. But the surprising part is that conservatives found Stephen Colbert to be funny, too. they found Stephen to be funny just as much as liberals. Now, here's the strange part. They believe that Colbert is using jokes and pretending that he is not conservative, all the while being conservative and making fun of liberal people by running down liberal people. In other words, they believe the stuff is true. They believe that Stephen Colbert is one of them, and he's using humor to slap around liberals. That's not even logic. For one thing, for someone not to understand that, they could not understand the concept of irony, nor can they understand the concept of satire. Now, I have another little theory on that. The theory is that the right, the conservatives, the retardicans, have for so many years, so many years, 30 or more, been fed a steady diet of lies, which they believe. They sucked it in and said, "May I have more, please?" They took the steady diet of lies constantly in from the right. And now, when they hear someone who is pretending that he is a conservative, what they hear is what they already believe. When he says the most outrageous, crazy stuff in the world about liberals, they believe it because they have already been conditioned to believe it. Goes back to my book, The Fox Syndrome. Oh, God, I hate doing this all the time. But when you're right, you're right. I'm sorry. I was right. So I'm going to say it. When a person is in a relationship where there is a delusional person who is spouting the delusions constantly, a normal person can become psychotic. They can take on a mental disorder known as shared psychotic disorder. It's real. It exists. And in my book, The Fox Syndrome, I cover the possibility, no, the exact happening, that the Fox Syndrome is real. That people who listen, who have a steady diet of Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, that bastard, Bill O'Reilly, Beck, Laura Ingraham, all of them, Peggy Newman, that they are listening to delusional people and they are sharing their delusions. They don't see them as lies. Now, Al Franken says that they're just liars, and that's okay. I'm sure part of it is a lie. Maybe the beginning of it was a lie. But now I think these right-wingers actually believe some of what they say. And I know that they have convinced their listeners that what they're saying is true. Therefore, these delusional people are constantly talking to these right-wing morons, and they are creating a shared psychotic disorder. This is a real mental disorder related to, in this case, related to right-wing media, which I call the Fox Syndrome. Right-wing media induced shared psychotic disorder. Every single week, I see it over and over and over. I feel vindicated. I feel like justice is finally served. No one's noticing it but me, but that's because my book was the worst-selling book in the entire world. Now, you people out there, whom I call the tens of people who listen to me, I have mentioned this over and over, and you know that there is such a psychotic disorder. They don't. They can't understand it. They can't get it through their head. It would create cognitive dissonance if they realized the truth, and we've already went through that, where they would use denial, which they are doing already, which is known as confirmational bias. They would use projection. They project their feelings on the commentators. And they use transference, where they transfer their hatred of someone good in their life upon liberals. Maybe a bit of Stockholm syndrome. Maybe they were abused physically, emotionally, sexually by some right-winger as a kid. And now they have developed a Stockholm syndrome where they have to go to Fox News and listen to this stuff all the time and continue to be abused. I don't know about that, but I do know the Fox syndrome is real. You have old Krauthammer who came up with the Bush derangement syndrome, something like that. Stupidest damn thing in the world I ever heard. His premise was that if you did not like Bush, you were deranged. If you did not like Bush, you were deranged. Because you had thoughts that Bush was an idiot, that Bush was evil, that Bush was doing wrong things, evil things, and not things that are good for America, that Bush didn't give a damn about you, only about rich people. You were deranged. You had Bush derangement syndrome. Well, I'm sorry, this psychiatrist is an idiot. Got that, Krauthammer? You're wrong. It's been proven. These people who did not like Bush because of the evil things we thought he was doing, well, he was doing them. Proof is out there. He was doing them. We were not deranged. Your diagnosis was wrong. Your diagnosis is wrong. Mine, on the other hand, the Fox syndrome, is correct. We've got proof on all of it. Beat you. Beat you. Like a red-headed stepson. So here we go. All this delusional stuff just out there floating around, and people are picking it up. And the senators are picking it up, too. And that's why you have Bachman out saying the crazy stuff that she's saying, because she, like Virginia Fox, they're not too damn smart. You know, they were kind of left out when that gift was being given. They just didn't quite get the intellectual capacity of a normal American. So they say really strange, crazy stuff, like Virginia Fox did. I've talked about her a few shows ago and her crazy rantings. Well, she came out not too long ago and blamed a victim who was a victim of gay bashing, of a horrible crime just because of who he was, and said that he wasn't a victim of a hate crime. He was a victim of theft. That's all it was. Well, look, sweetie, Virginia, my dear, there is no Santa Claus. And there is no reality in what you're saying. I am very sorry, young lady. But if someone decides that they hate ugly-looking Republican senators and attacked you and killed you, and then on a second thought took your money, that doesn't make it a crime of theft. That makes it a hate crime. If they hate you because of your politics, or if they hate you because of you're a woman, I think you may be. You could be in drag. I couldn't tell, and I never got a good look at your Adam's apple. I hear those things will be sand down anyway. So I don't believe that if someone attacks you and hurts you, and don't anybody ever do that, by the way. Don't do it. I'm just using this for an example. I don't think that you could say it was a hate crime. I think you'd just have to say that it was robbery if they took 10 cents off from you. You're not logical, Virginia. You're not logical, Bachman. You both suffer from the Fox syndrome. Right-wing media-induced shared psychotic disorder. Get treatment. Get well. You'll be okay. I still don't want you in Congress because you're crazy. But you'll be okay. You can make it. Maybe in some supported housing. They could put you in some supported housing, you know, and that would probably be good for you. You know, keep you from hurting yourself. It could be nice. But get you out of Congress before you hurt any more Americans. And take Sean Hannity with you, that coward. Getting into the thing we're talking about in the first part of this show. Cowards. Sean Hannity gets up and, yeah, I'll be waterboarded. It's no big deal. I can take it. and any chickens out. I'll do it as a charity for the soldiers. So I offer money. Overman offers money, a lot more than I can. And Sean Hannity keeps his mouth shut.
Well, it'll just go away.
You're a coward, Sean. Got that? You're a liar and you're a coward. Last segment. Virginia, Bachman, you, Miss Fox, you, Miss Bachman, you're delusional. You're flippin' delusional. And the person who helped make you delusional is delusional himself. And a liar and a coward. This don't bode well for the Republican Party and their minions. But so many of you are just downright crackers. So many of you are liars and crazy and vicious and evil. It does not bode well for America to have you in the positions that you are in. So there's a correlation between Obama and Carter and pig flu. But no correlation with Bush 2 and SARS and bird flu. And I'm not going to mention the other ones because I want y'all to actually go on Fancast, bring that up and listen to it. But I'll jump to the other one. And Reagan and AIDS. No correlation at all. Do you know, Bachman, when I stop to think about it, you may have something there. You may actually have something there, Miss Bachman. I want you to listen to me and listen to me really well because I want you to start speaking about this. This is something that you probably overlooked, and this is something that goes right along with what you've been saying. Think about this for 1 second. FDR. FDR. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in a wheelchair. He was crippled. When he was president, he was crippled by polio. Think about this, Michelle. Think about it. Don't you think that it's likely? Don't you think that it's probable that what happened was that Roosevelt was in his basement laboratory experimenting with some marijuana over here because liberals do that, and also experimenting with a new strain of polio. So when he could get into office, because he knew he was going to be president one day because, you know, we got all that stuff rigged. We put voting stuff together with dead people in cemeteries so that we can win elections. We steal election boxes. We bring illegals in and let them vote for us. You know, all the lies that you people say. So think about it, Michelle. Is it possible, Ms. Bachman, that because Roosevelt knew he was going to be president one day, he was already going to work on his pandemic that he was going to force upon America, just like pig flu? This was polio. Maybe he was working on a new strain of polio, and it got him. He made a mistake, and it put him in a wheelchair. You have got it. You've got the connection now. Go for it, Michelle. Go for it. Tell the world this connection, that it was Roosevelt's working towards a new strain of polio that caused him to catch polio that put him in a wheelchair. Because evil Democrats always wants a new pandemic to send out across the world. Does it hurt, Miss Fox? Miss Virginia Fox, does it hurt? Does it hurt, Miss Bachman? Miss Michelle Bachman, does it hurt? Does it hurt being so damn stupid?
What drives you on can drive you mad. A million lies to tell yourself is all you ever had. And what you need is what you get. What you need is what you get.
Thanks for being with us on this first hour. This is Rick Goodner. You're at Rick's Place here at Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. We'll see you in a few minutes and finish out the last hour.
Radio Network, America's liberal voice. Hang in there, Rangers. We're fixing to be right back.
Hi, boys and girls. This is Rick Goodner, part of the Weekend Wrecking Crew. I'm here to tell you that you cannot miss Billy Shears. The man knows his music. The man knows what you're thinking. Tune in and listen. You'll be surprised. He's going to play the very song that you were thinking that you needed to hear. Ah, he's a genius. Maybe a bit psychic. I promise you. Tune in on the weekend, listen to Billy Shears Night Sounds, and you will hear the song you've been waiting to hear. And you'll enjoy your time as much as I do. Right here, on the Horn, Head On Radio Network. Make sure you don't miss what you've been waiting to hear with Billy Shears.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Play as time goes by.
Welcome back, Rangers, to Rick's Place. Now, here's the number one ranger, the proprietor of Rick's and Horn's psychotherapist, Rick Goodner.
Road that will take me home. The
Oh, yes, Rangers, we will be heading on home. Pretty soon, Rick's place will be closing. And this is Rick Kudner, and you are at Head On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice. We're going to be closing up the doors and skiddy-addy on out of here. There's a couple things I'd like to talk to you about before we head off, and I'm going to finish out this last hour. One thing is Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, all these idiots start bragging all the time about these wonderful numbers that they have, these great listeners that listen to them all the time. I'm going to dispel that myth, because it is a myth. It's a qualified myth, but it's still a myth. Number one, if you happen to be a paranoid person, you're going to listen to the people who reinforce your paranoia. You're going to listen to the people that you already believe. So right there, a segment of the American population is always going to listen to Limbaugh, always going to listen to Beck, always going to listen to Hannity, that bastard, always going to listen to Fox News, because they reinforce the paranoia. So yes, they do have a nice little base there. A good percentage of America are paranoid, and the Fox syndrome people feed that paranoia. So yes, they do have them. The largest percentage of people that listen to Fox, Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, that bastard, Bill O'Reilly, Beck, well, they're not exactly in the 55 to 24 demographics. You know, the one that everybody's shooting for. Most of the people that listen to them are in the 60s and up. Okay. If a person is 65, or if they're paranoid and have other mental disorders, then they're not going to be working. They're not going to be working. Not that much. So they can sit at home all day with the radio running, with the TV running, getting reinforced in their paranoid thought process. And then you have those 60 to 75-year-old people who do let the TV run all day as background noise. It's not that they're constantly watching all that time, but anytime any surveys are done and they say, what are you watching? What are you listening to? Well, it's Fox News. Well, it's Rush Limbaugh. But in a lot of the cases, they can't even hear the damn thing. Of course, if they're paranoid, it's turned up full blast and they're sitting staring in front of the TV looking for all the secret messages. But for the older people, it's background noise. Also, an awful lot of people in nursing homes leave their TV going all day, all night. Guess which channel it's usually tuned to? Are they watching it? Some are. Some are tripping out on their medication. Some are just laying there drooling. No offense. I'm going to be in there myself one of these days. And I'm going to kick the first person who turns my TV on Fox. So when you're looking at a demographic of people who do not work, and they have the mindset of the Fox News, of the Fox syndrome type people, those are the people they're going to be tuned into. And because it's going all day long, it looks like the station is getting an enormous amount of people watching it. But, you know, look, let's be honest. When you get 2 million people, 2 million out of 300 million, 350 million, watching Fox at any given time, and it's the same people every time, what do you have? You have a very small slice of the population. You know, the rest of us are out working during the day. Then we try to have family time, real family time. We can't sit there and let Fox run constantly. We can't sit there and have Limbaugh running constantly. And let's face it, if you live in a smaller community or one of the mid or western states and you're driving in your car, you're not going to get classic rock. You're not going to get headbanger music. You're going to get talk radio. And if you get talk radio, the only thing you're going to get is right-wing radio. These numbers are skewed. These numbers are screwed. They don't really represent a good view of the population. So when Limbaugh or Fox start raving about their numbers, I don't take it to heart, and I don't get sad about it. Because I know their demographics. I have been in nursing homes. I have seen what's on. I have been in hardware stores and sporting goods stores and Walmarts where they play Fox constantly. That skews the numbers too. So no, little boys and girls, they're not doing that darn well. And the people who are watching them are not the people who are going to buy anything from their sponsors. They're not really going to buy anything from their sponsors. And if these stations did not have right-wing money rolling into them, they would all be closed. And that be the truth. So anytime that Bill O'Reilly gets up and talks about his 2 million viewers that beats everybody, it's garbage. You got people who are paranoid. You got people who are demented. You got people who are old and drooling. You got people who are on meds. You've got people having it on all day long as background noise. And a lot of them don't vote. The paranoid people don't vote because they don't want the government to see them. Because they think they're going to be out to get them anyway. People in the nursing homes vote, but it's usually when the kids come in and have them sign the absentee ballot to vote for who the kids want them to vote for. I mean, I know. I've seen it, and it's sad. Lifelong Democrats in a nursing home can't see hardly worth diddly. Some of them demented, absolutely demented, and their kids will bring in absentee ballots and have them to vote for Republicans who they wouldn't vote for in any way whatsoever. They would not do it. But their Republican kids will bring in the ballots, have them to sign it, vote for the Republican because that's who they want them to vote for. And then switch their TV off from Oprah over to Fox. That be the issue. That's it, guys. You don't worry one bit about their demographics because it's skewed and screwed and nothing to worry about. Okay, we can go home and relax. They don't have anybody at all watching them that's going to make a difference in the world. Nice and easy. Now, in this next hour, I'm going to run you another tape. First of all, I'm going to run it all the way through. I'm going to let you listen to it. And then I'm going to do a horrible thing. I'm going to cut it up in pieces. And I'm going to let you listen to what this crazy woman says and then my commentary about it. And then we'll finish up after that. But what we have here is an admission of a crime, a confession to a crime. What we have here is condescending behavior, narcissism, and stupidity. Enjoy.
Considering that, the torture, the incidents at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, including the indefinite internment of detainees there, how are we supposed to continue promoting America as this guiding light of democracy, and how are we supposed to win hearts and minds in the world as long as we continue with these actions?
Well, first of all, you do what's right. That's the most important thing, that you make judgments what's right. And in terms of enhanced interrogation and rendition and all the issues around the detainees, Abu Ghraib is, and everyone said Abu Ghraib was not, policy Abu Ghraib was wrong, and nobody would argue in favor of it.
Except that information that's come out since then, it speaks against that.
No. The information that comes out since then continues to say that Abu Ghraib was wrong. Abu Ghraib was. But in terms of the enhanced interrogation and so forth, anything that was legal and was going to make this country safer, the president wanted to do. Nothing that was illegal, and nothing that was going to make the country less safe. And I'll tell you something, unless you were there in a position of responsibility after September 11th, you cannot possibly imagine the dilemmas that you faced in trying to protect Americans. And I know a lot of people are second-guessing now, but let me tell you what the second-guessing that would have really hurt me. If the second-guessing had been about 3,000 more Americans dying because we didn't do everything we could to protect them. If you were there in a position of authority and watched Americans jump out of 80-story buildings because these murderous tyrants went after innocent people, then you were determined to do anything that you could that was legal to prevent that from happening again. And so I think people do understand that. Now, as to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and so forth, I agree with you. We have tried to use the trafficking in persons and all of those measures, human rights reports and so forth, to put a spotlight on the kinds of problems that you have in places like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or Oman or other places. But you don't have the luxury in foreign policy of saying, all right, I won't deal with that country because I don't like its human rights practices. You don't have that luxury. So if you need Saudi Arabia to fight al-Qaeda internally, which is, by the way, where al-Qaeda came from, or if you need Saudi Arabia to be a part of a coalition that's going to help to bring a Palestinian state, you can't decide not to deal with Saudi Arabia because of its problems in human rights. Or if you need to make sure that the Gulf is safe from Iranian influence. And you want to talk about human rights abusers? Iran.
I'm well aware.
Yeah. So foreign policy is full of tough choices, very tough choices. The world is not a bunch of easy choices in which you get to make ones that always feel good.
I'm aware, but even even in World War II, as we faced Nazi Germany, probably the greatest threat that America has ever faced. Even then,
all due respect, Nazi Germany never attacked the homeland of the United States.
No, but they bombed our allies.
Just a second. 3,000 Americans died in the Twin Towers and in the Pentagon.
500,000 died in World War II.
No.
And yet we did not torture the prisoners of war.
And we didn't torture anybody here either. All
we
right?
tortured them in Guantanamo.
No, dear, you're wrong. All right, you're wrong. We did not torture anyone. And Guantanamo Bay, by the way, was considered a model, quote, medium security prison by representatives of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe who went there to see it. Did you know that?
Were they present for the interrogations?
No. Did you know that the organization... Just answer me. Did you know that the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe said Guantanamo was a model medium security prison?
No, but I feel that changes nothing.
Did you know that?
I did not know that, but that changes absolutely nothing.
Wait a second. If you didn't know that, maybe before you make allegations about Guantanamo, you should read. Now, the ICRC also had access to Guantanamo. And they made no allegations about interrogations at Guantanamo. What they did say is that they believe that indefinite detention, where people didn't know whether they could come up for trial, which is why we tried through the military commission system to let people come up for trial. Those trials were stayed by whom? Who kept us from holding the trial?
I can't answer that question.
Do your homework first.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So I read a recent report recently he said that you, in a memo, you were the one who authorized torture to the
people.
Sorry, not torture.
Thanks.
Waterboarding. Waterboarding. Is waterboarding torture?
The president instructed us that nothing we would do would be outside of our obligations, legal obligations, under the Convention Against Torture. So that's, and by the way, I didn't authorize anything. I conveyed the authorization of the administration to the agency that they had policy authorization subject to the Justice Department's clearance.
Okay.
That's what I did.
Is waterboarding torture?
And I just said, the United States was told, we were told, nothing that violates our obligations under the Convention Against Torture. And so, by definition, if it was authorized by the President, it did not violate our obligations under the Convention Against Torture.
Thank you.
All right.
Secretary Mike, can I bring you to dinner?
Yes.
Okay, Rangers, there you had it. That is, of course, the Con Rice, little Connie, and she went to her school that she was a big person in, and she was talking to some students, and a student asked her a very intelligent, a very respectful question. How is America going to be the guiding light of the world if, you know, we engage in torture and do things that's inappropriate? And so the con starts talking, and she says, well, listen to this.
Considering that, the torture, the incidents at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, including the indefinite deferment of detainees there, how are we supposed to continue promoting America as this guiding light of democracy, and how are we supposed to win hearts and minds in the world as long as we continue these actions?
Well, first of all, you do what's right. That's the most important thing that you make sure is what's right. And in terms of enhanced interrogation and rendition and all the issues around the detainees, Abu Ghraib is, and everyone said Abu Ghraib was not, policy of Abu Ghraib was wrong, and nobody would argue in favor of Abu Ghraib.
Except that information that's come out since then, it speaks against that.
No. The information that comes out since then continues to say that Abu Ghraib was wrong. Abu Ghraib was. But
you will note that the question was intelligent and insightful, and to the point. Then you also note the mealy-mouth response of the former, let's just call her Connie. Which, I'm being condescending, but that's okay because she deserves it. You'll hear about that later. But to begin with, she says, we got to do what's right. And I agree. More on that in a second. Then she gets mealy mouth. And then the mealy mouth part, she said, what happened at Abu Ghraib was wrong. It was wrong. And it was not standard operating procedure. It was wrong. It was some bad apples. You know, that kind of garbage again. Because they can't make up new lies. They just kind of have to stick to their old lies. And when the young man pointed out the fact that now it's been shown that the techniques used at Abu Ghraib and were done there by the soldiers were approved by her administration and sanctioned, when that was pointed out, she lies. No more mealy mouth. She lies. No, not true. Because even today, everybody says that was wrong. Well, she didn't answer the question. She lied and said no. And then she mealy mouthed and said, Abu Ghraib was wrong. Well, okay, yes, it was wrong. But you're not touching on the issue that now documents have proven that it was standard operating procedure and it was ordered by you and the White House. She's covering herself. She's setting up her defense. Now, I imagine she's practiced this a few times. I'd like to see her pull this stuff that she's done with this young man and the next young man in court. Oh, and I do want to see her in court. Not a truth commission. I want to see her in court.
Abu Ghraib was. But in terms of the enhanced interrogation and so forth, anything that was legal and was going to make this country safer, the president wanted to do. Nothing that was illegal and nothing that was going to make the country less safe.
So here's the setup now, starting with their defense. We used only things that were legal and necessary. So, they were approved and they were legal. They were good things. They were legal. We didn't do anything that was illegal. Everything we did was completely legal. So, when the president does it, it's legal. The president decides I need to die, I can be shot. And that's it. It's legal. I'm sorry, we have a constitution that says that is not legal. We have a constitution that says that we don't torture. We have a constitution that says that people have rights not to be spied upon. We have a constitution and we have laws that say we don't torture. And we've signed agreements with other parts of the world that says we will not torture. So we broke agreements, we broke laws, we broke treaties, we broke the constitution. You, the Republicans, broke those. Not we. You, the Republicans. And then in the next part, she gets really, really good. You just don't understand. You don't know. You weren't there. And you can't know because you weren't there. So, if you weren't there, then you don't know. And if you don't know, you can't judge. And if you can't judge, we're okay. We're skating free. It's garbage. Connie, it's garbage. You are part of a torture ring. Okay, going back to ancient history again. When I was a kid, and you'd go into a little store that always had the little sex magazines out on the rack, and I'd look across at those, and no, before Playboy was really, really big, then they had these mystery magazines that were very sexual in nature, stories and pictures and stuff. And about two-thirds of them were pictures of women dressed in Nazi uniforms on top and then panties and hose and garters and stuff down below, all black, with whips in their hands, hitting guys. And some of the others would have Nazi men standing up in their SS uniforms with whips in their hands and a tied-up woman with scared eyes looking up at them. This was in the 60s. And the war was over in 45. And still for years after, many years after, erotic magazines that catered to the S&M crowd, even though it'd be considered soft porn today, was plastered all over the newsstands, the store stands, for even little kids to see, that related back to torture and abuse in a sexual manner. Connie, my dear, before much longer, it's going to be your image on magazines like that. It's going to be Bush and Rumsfeld's image with a poor, scared girl and they walk around with their whips. Because you are the embodiment now of what the Nazis and the Gestapo was then. I'm not making that comparison. History's making that comparison. This is sick. And you are fighting like hell to save your reputation and yourself out of jail. I hope you get what's coming to you. And then on the last part of the tape, she goes into this crazy little thing that wasn't even asked about. Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and stuff like that and human rights. She's throwing in this human rights stuff like, we were just so good. We were working so hard for human rights. Forget about the torture stuff. Would anybody be torturing people if they were working hard for human rights? I mean, that's what that crap was about. Because no one asked about it, Connie. No one asked about it.
And I'll tell you something. Unless you were there in a position of responsibility after September 11th, you cannot possibly imagine the dilemmas that you faced in trying to protect Americans. And I know a lot of people are second-guessing now, but let me tell you what the second-guessing that would have really hurt me. If the second-guessing had been about 3,000 more Americans dying because we didn't do everything we could to protect them. If you were there in a position of authority and watched Americans jump out of 80-story buildings because these murderous tyrants went after innocent people, then you were determined to do anything that you could that was legal to prevent that from happening again. And so I think people do understand that. Now, as to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and so forth, I agree with you. We have tried to use the trafficking in persons and all of those measures, human rights.
Sure. But even in World War II, as we faced Nazi Germany, probably the greatest threat that America has ever faced, even then...
all due respect, Nazi Germany never attacked the homeland of the United States.
No, but they bombed our allies.
Just a second. 3,000 Americans died in the Twin Towers and in the Pentagon.
500,000 died in World War II.
No,
and yet we did not torture the prisoners of war.
And we didn't torture anybody here either. All right?
We tortured them in Guantanamo
Bay. No, dear, you're wrong. All right, you're wrong.
Okay, I will admit that I cut out the part where she was going through this craziness about Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and human rights stuff to try to show that she was such a humanitarian. I cut that part out on this section. It was in the original. But the young man asked a wonderful question. Or he tried to. He started to. And like all right-wingers, whenever you get a question going and they realize that it's about to be a hard one, they put up straw dogs. And so did Condi. He said, even in World War II, where America faced the greatest threat. Oh, no. 3,000 people died in the towers. That was the greatest threat. That was it. It was not Germany. No, we didn't have a great threat from them. They never attacked us. Okay, Connie, to begin with, the 3,000 people that died in that tower was under your watch. Y'all systematically did not look at any of the intel related to bin Laden wanting to attack America. Y'all did not look at anything related to stopping the terrorist attack when you were warned that something was about to happen. You did nothing. Nothing. So it happened on your watch. I won't say it was your fault, although it was. But that was your felon. So now you're saying that 3,000 Americans, which is horrible, guys. I know that. It is a horrible thing. And that was a devastating attack on America. True. But to say that World War II pales in the face of 19 hijackers? We had the possibility of actually being invaded, overran by separate countries at the same time, and our American government destroyed. Not 19 hijackers. We're talking thousands and thousands of men in an army, two different armies, three different armies, actually. And you're saying that was not a bigger threat? You're myopic. No, you have tunnel vision, lady. You don't know what you're doing. And then you come up and say, Germany never attacked America. Do you remember Germany's ally, Japan? Do you remember a little time in December the 7th when Germany's ally, Japan, did a sneak attack on American soil? You know, in that foreign country where Obama was born? Do you remember that?